This podcast is brought to you by Innovid and their Harmony Initiative. Innovid believes that TV should be open for everyone and controlled by no one. And the time to make that vision a reality is now. That's why Innovid created Harmony, an industry-wide initiative to address the biggest challenges facing CTV advertising today. By optimizing at the infrastructure level, Harmony aims to improve efficiency, enhance transparency and control, and increase ROI, all while reducing carbon emissions and providing better viewing experiences for all. Find out more and get involved at innovid.com/harmony. Welcome to the Marketecture Podcast. I'm Ari Paparo. I am joined by Eric Franchi, who's back from vacation, and our special guest today, Larry Koenig, who's the Global Head of Product at MIQ. Larry, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
We're really excited to hear what you have to say based on video SPO or CTV SPO. So that's a lot of acronyms, and we'll get there in one quick second. Eric, where'd you go on vacation?
I went to Texas.
All right. Do you listen to a lot of Beyonce down there?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. Let's call it that.
It was awesome. I like getting out there out of the Northeast into different parts of the country. It was an amazing time. But I listened to the pod. It was great last week. Mike Shields did a great job.
He did. Housekeeping, this week's vendor interview is with Ad Marketplace, a search SEM product. Next week, we have Harry Cargman from Cargo, which is an interesting interview I did because a lot of people don't really know what Cargo does, and they do a great job explaining it in that interview. And I want to remind everyone that both Eric and I are at Possible in Miami next week. Come say hi to us. We're going to do the same thing we did last year with person on the street interviews, where we'll just open up voice memos and you can tell us what you think. And if it's interesting, you'll end up on the pod. So with that, let's jump in with Lara. So Lara, I had the idea to invite her up to this because I saw her presentation at Ad Exchanger's CTV Connect conference about 3 weeks ago. And it was really excellent. It's one of those things where everyone was taking notes and people were asking copies of the presentation. It was so had so many interesting insights. So I said, well, let's get Lara on the pod. So Lara, before we start jumping in, why don't you just give us like the elevator pitch on who you are and what MIQ is?
Yeah, definitely. Well, first, flattery gets you everywhere with me. I live for praise, so really appreciate that. So I am the global head of product at MIQ. I've been at MIQ about 9 years. I make a joke like, born here, going to die here. But in my capacity in product, I've kind of run a couple different roles. I spent about the first 6 years managing our trading teams, really hands-on keys, activation groups, which gave a lot of insights into DSPs and sort of publishers. And then the last couple of years, I've focused on sort of building product capabilities around our ad tech partner ecosystem, which includes a lot of supply path optimization, which has been super, super buzzy the last like 2 years, but really picked up a lot of steam in the last 6 months as well.
Right, right. So I think I'm going to put out a straw man naive argument and you're going to just demolish it, which is a lot of people think that CTV is pretty consolidated. There's only like 10 major media companies that have quality CTV inventory. There's only a couple of ad servers and a couple of exchanges that are really good at CTV. So it should be pretty straightforward to buy that inventory. You should just basically log into Magnite or log into Trade Desk, buy from Magnite. It serves a freewheel. Everyone's happy. And it's a premium CPM and there's not much to worry about. And you are going to tell me otherwise.
Yeah. Well, the way I like to think about it is like if I were a business owner sort of representing sort of CTV content or inventory, I would want to diversify my demand channels or any business wants to diversify their demand. So where they're sourcing revenue from, you never want to be over leveraged on one partner or one technology provider. And so I think in the past when CTV was kind of just emerging and in its sort of programmatic infancy, your thesis was correct. It was pretty clean, pretty simple. There were a couple sort of incumbent sort of providers on the technology side, both ad server, SSP, as well as DSP. But in the last year or so, there's been a ton of investment into CTV sort of in the ecosystem. And there's been a lot of challenger entrants sort of trying to capture a lot of CTV demand and sort of prove out value to publishers. At the same time, like publishers broadly in CTV and web are getting squeezed a little bit right now. And so the sort of race for incremental demand is hotter than ever. we're seeing that a lot of these sort of content owners and media owners are testing a lot more partners than they ever have before, which is leading to like a much more complex supply ecosystem versus sort of the perception 2 years ago, which was, you know, just run through Magnite or FreeWheel and you're good to go.
Right, right. So some of your findings were kind of shocking, that there was, correct me if I'm wrong, 141 different paths to buy a single piece of CTV inventory.
Yeah, 114, but we're nearly there. There's a couple like reasons why supply paths are ballooning. One is just a fundamental of like how these content and media owners are distributing content through to consumers. So this concept of like carriage rights exists in TV quite commonly, where you know that you can buy a slice of broadcast inventory from, you know, the addressable provider, you can buy it from the ISP, you can buy it from the broadcaster directly. And they all have like multi-year, you know, 5 year plus revenue agreements that come with minimum commitments in TV. The same media companies are the ones that are sort of producing this content for CTV as well. So this concept of carriage rights has really translated over to programmatic for CTV. So there's a lot of like authorized distributors that have a legitimate direct claim to sales rights for a lot of the same inventory. So it might be for a single app or a single show on an app, the broadcaster has the rights to sell that, the app itself has the rights to sell that, as well as the OEM. Because when you're thinking about like how that media owner gets the content to the consumer, all of those companies play a participation role in that. And so they have a different sort of varying degree of rights to sell it. So I think that's one of the reasons, which is super interesting.
So we're talking, let's give an example. So you're watching, let's say, the NBC app on a Roku channel on a Samsung TV. And so all three of those entities might be able to sell the ads.
Yeah. So you're watching Yellow Jackets on Roku channel, or on, let's say, on Pluto on Roku device. It's like NBC would be able to monetize that. Pluto would be able to monetize it as well as Roku, because they all are playing a distribution role in getting that content to the consumer. So from a buyer's perspective, you can buy that same ad impression through all of those paths.
Right. So how do you get from those, from that scenario, say three, to 114?
Yeah. So that's where the SSPs start to play a role, as well as increasingly intermediaries. So there might be sort of three distribution groups, again, the OEM, the app, and the broadcaster. But then there's the SSPs they're buying through. So it might be a Magnite, a FreeWheel. It might be some of the challenger SSPs that are trying to get into CTV, whether it's Beachfront. The legacy incumbents on web are starting to play around here. It's like Index, OpenX, PubMatic, you know, Xandr, all of those guys. And then outside of the top level SSP level, who are all largely working with the same app providers, excluding a few like super premium SVODs who are consolidating their ad tech stack. These players are then also working with more intermediaries downstream. So like ID providers, server-side ad insertion companies, interactive creative element companies that are trying to bring additional demand to the publisher through these SSP integrations. And so you've got to get to the app, through the SSP, through all of their intermediary network, and that's what balloons out to the 114.
Right. And this is all kosher, right? We're not talking about spoofing, fraud, or anything. We're talking about legal, upstanding agreements with all these parties.
Correct. Yeah. So there is a risk of spoofing depending on how you buy it. We have sort of come up with this research using supply chain logs. So the IAB's S-chain object, which is like super, super critical for us to validate who's participating and whether it's authorized or not. You run into more risk of spoofing when you run through either like third-party curated library deals where you're not directly sort of setting up the inventory, or when you're running through open market, just because there's a lot more incentive for fraudsters to play in that space.
Yeah, so let's talk about those marketplace deals, because one of your findings, if I understand it correctly, was that when you get a default deal that's maybe in your DSP's deal library, it could be incredibly duplicative.
Yeah, so there's a couple things that happen with third-party marketplace deals. We're big proponents, just on the nose of it, for setting up your own first-party deal ecosystems. It helps build a lot of sort of trust and credibility between buyer and seller, which is ultimately the goal of programmatic. So, but there's pitfalls when you're running through third-party curated deal libraries, so like a DSP library that sits there off the shelf for any buyer to log into. One is that you're not quite sure the composition of it because you haven't directly negotiated it yourself. So oftentimes we'll see that like a run of AVOD deal, for example, or like, you know, a run of Broadcaster X deal, they might include all of the different apps that you can potentially buy that broadcaster through in that deal, which includes the AVODs, the SVODs, as well as like the TVE super premium stuff. But the problem with that is that all of those come at really different price points. And if you're buying through one of these library deals, you're sort of taking a one bid fits all approach to it. And so buyers are like oftentimes drastically overpaying for what they could see more efficiencies on, setting up more isolated sort of one-to-one deals in that ecosystem.
Yeah, so I think that's one of the more shocking slides or findings in this presentation you have, which is on a single piece of inventory, you had media CPM averages that ranged from $8 to $21. I think I remember, maybe, yeah, $8.93 was the lowest, and the highest was close to $22 on the exact same piece of inventory. How is that possible?
So that was the same app bundle ID bought through a single SSP deal ID. And that's really where the intermediaries come into play, where there were more participants in the sort of supply chain, which were driving those costs up. And also there's a lot of different pricing and revenue agreements that various SSPs have with different publishers. So one sort of SSP, let's say the incumbents like a Magnite and FreeWheel, might represent more of overall demand for a single publisher. And so their kind of commitment to that publisher is to sort of increase demand channels and also maximize yield. Publishers are also looking to sort of diversify their SSP stack as well. And so they're introducing all these challenger SSPs that sometimes can offer the inventory at lower price points in order to sort of prove out their ability to drive demand for that publisher. So that's one of the reasons that you see this huge variation between like $9 to $22. And the opportunity for buyers is to kind of leverage data to navigate that. It's like, how do you pick the right platforms to the right app bundle ID? Leveraging sort of DSP data and supply chain data can be super critical for that.
So if I think about it, at $8, it is, true SPO. In the middle range, it's whether it's base SSPs or challenger SSPs, everybody's like competing for inventory, playing with margin, so on and so forth, layering data performance. And maybe at the top end, do you see like, the classic ad network arbs happening? Or is this really like, SSPs competing and having such a wide range?
I think the majority of the price difference is just true one-to-one direct SSP competition. The other consideration is the SSPs that different buyers are actually activating through. A majority of ad investment is in CTV is still consolidated to like those two large incumbents. And so when you think about like how you have to bid as a buyer in order to win that SSP auction, probably bid more competitively in order to outcompete all other buyers. But if there's a different demand channel you're sort of buying through, a challenger SSP that maybe less buyers are opted into at the moment, you can exit that auction a lot quicker and a lot more efficiently. So I think there's opportunity for buyers to really distribute how they're accessing, again, authorized direct supply from publishers through multiple partners.
Right. You wouldn't want to just buy the cheapest channels. That would probably cause lots of other problems.
Yeah, and a race to the bottom is never the answer. It should be a balanced and distributed sort of plan. I just think there's risk in going all in on one or two ad tech partners, as is the case with when you buy through a DSP. You know, there's so much complexity and fragmentation in the market in terms of like commercial agreements between SSPs, DSPs, publishers, and then through to buyers. That an all eggs in one basket approach for CTV just does not work right now.
Is a takeaway here from the supply side, from the media company streamer perspective, is that the SSPs are actually adding a lot of value. I mean, if they're able to drive up the CPM 2x, and bring lots of happy buyers, that's a positive thing. Yeah.
Yeah, so I think the point I'd pick on there is lots of happy buyers. I think with kind of a consolidated or commoditized CTV ecosystem like we saw 2 years ago, there really was this kind of escalation in CTV pricing where it was kind of blocking a lot of new entrants out of the market from an advertiser perspective. You know, like folks that were getting cheaper rates on linear through their local buyers, like they were never going to swap to programmatic, even though there's efficiencies, because of the sort of rate discrepancy and this consolidation. Also, you know, key sectors like performance marketers that have ROAS goals or CPA goals, like a high price CTV is not going to work for them. Or political marketers is another example. So like high priced commoditized ad tech stacks in CTV were kind of limiting, I think, some of the growth of the channel. And so that's where a lot of these challenger SSPs are coming in, where they can bring in net new incremental demand to publishers for advertisers that they wouldn't have accessed through those, you know, high price points that they're getting high yield at. So it's adding to the overall revenue pie for publishers. It's not diminishing the yield that they're getting from their legacy partners.
Let's talk about the consumer a little bit. So you indicate that 64% of the top ad-supported streaming apps are overlapping, or the consumers are have a 64% overlap among the top ad-supported streaming apps. What does that mean? And what does that mean for advertisers?
Yeah, well, I like to think about it in terms of my own viewing habits. I call myself this like the subscription daddy for my friends. So I host all of our logins. But we probably have like eight different subscriptions. We've got Paramount Plus, Apple TV, Netflix, Prime Video. I also own a Samsung TV, so I see the Samsung TV Plus channels every time I turn it on. So there's just so much fragmentation in terms of where consumers can access content, similar to how ad tech buyers can access certain supply, that it's kind of mandating multiple subscription services,
Right.
which means that, you know, for me and my four friends, you can access all of us on the exact same apps, and there's eight of them. But for the ad tech buyer, the price point for those eight apps is going to be wildly different. And so it's like, how do you think about reaching the right audience at the most efficient price for the marketer? There's a ton of opportunity there.
Obviously, there's some households that haven't cut the cord yet who skew a lot older. But is there also some households who are overwhelmingly watching non-ad supported like Netflix, HBO, and we're just very hard to reach?
Yeah, I think if you again look at my friend group 2 years ago, like we didn't have any ad supported licenses. But what you're seeing the broadcasters do is start to remove the option to remove ads. So like Paramount Plus is a great example where like, or Peacock, sorry, they've got sort of great ad content, or they've got great broadcaster content. So as a consumer, I want to watch it. And I put up with the ads just because they don't give me the option to remove them.
Yeah, I'm a big Peacock stan. And they tricked me. I have the strangest user acquisition story in history of Peacock, which is they acquired my company for many millions of dollars and gave me a free subscription, but only for 1 year. And now at the end of the year, I was like, okay, I'll pay for it. So that's the ROI on me as a consumer.
I agree that Peacock has a really good ad experience. They are doing a lot of those pause ads and doing a great job with it. The other thing I've started to see is Amazon. So you know they moved to ad supported, and I watched a movie with the family this weekend, and it was brought to us by a single advertiser. So I think there's like this real boom in this stuff that we've been talking about happening like right now.
Yeah. Another a great example of that from Amazon is Jury Duty. That was like really their first entrant into like exclusive content, a brand new show that was super buzzy, only ad supported. You could not opt out of ads for that show, which so I think you'll see a lot more of that in the future.
So let's get to recommendations. So what should marketers and agencies be doing about this situation where there's a very complex supply path? There's a lot of duplication. There's a lot of price discovery. And maybe taking the easy way out is not the right thing to do.
Yeah, so I think top level buy through trusted partners. There's a lot of entrants in the CTV space right now, and testing is well and good, but definitely make sure that your partners are authorized to represent that inventory. Second is if you can, if you've got analytics and data science team that have capacity to do it, There's a ton of really rich data assets you can get from SSPs and DSPs, whether it's SSP feeds or supply chain logs that help really demystify this and bring a lot of trust into what is could be perceived as a murky ecosystem. So ask for data, like the buyers hold the power here if they just ask. I think third thing is set up your own deal libraries, sort of avoid some of those third-party pricing markups by buying off-the-shelf libraries. One, publishers can't really recognize your spend if you buy through those, and so you're kind of diminishing your buying power through that. And two, you're competing with sort of every other buyer in that ecosystem, which just automatically is going to drive your pricing up. And then the fourth thing is like there's also, we talked a lot about SSP fragmentation and challenger SSPs. There's also a lot of consolidation in where CTV dollars sit today on the DSP side. I think one publisher told us it was like 80% of their revenue came from a single DSP, which again is causing sort of prices to increase for buyers because it's a lot more competitive bidding environment. So we've seen a lot of efficiencies just by trying different routes on the DSP side as well as the SSP.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think there's, we'll talk in the news section about Innovid's announcement, but I think there's a lot of folks who are jockeying to try to some of this SPO simpler or skip steps and potentially save money. And it's going to be a bit of a battle, I think, between a lot of these parties. Well, Lara and MIQ have been courteous enough to allow us to give our listeners a copy of this amazing presentation. This is, I always like to tell people, it's not a paid presentation. Lara, there's no compensation being given to Marketecture by MIQ. We just really liked it. So if you would like that link, you should subscribe to our newsletter. It'll be in the newsletter on Monday. You subscribe at news.marketecture.tv, and we will link to this podcast. We'll also have a link to the original presentation in PDF form. Lara, that was awesome. Thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thanks so much for having me again. Appreciate it.
All right. So let's take a quick break and we'll be back with news of the week. A lot of really interesting stuff going on around privacy and around Forbes and a lot of other stuff. So we'll be back. This podcast is sponsored by Adelaide. You've probably heard of Adelaide by now. This month, they announced a new product, Adelaide for Publishers. For the first time, publishers can leverage attention metrics to curate inventory, deliver attention insights, and drive higher CPMs. Join The Weather Company, NPR, Westwood One, Cumulus Media, and other leading publishers taking advantage of the attention economy's most popular metric, AU. Maybe one day Mark will convince me to sell guaranteed AU slots on Marketecture, but probably not. Check out AdelaideMetrics.com/AFP for more information.
And we're back. News of the week. So a lot of interesting things going on this week. Last week, when you guys recorded News of the Week, the news about Forbes had just broken. So you took some time, you know, dug into the analytics report, which was 30 pages long, so something, you know, like, you know, something usual for analytics, but, you know, incredibly difficult for everybody else with our, you know, thanks to the internet, ADHD, and, you know, wrote a great post. And there's still been a little bit of fallout and discussion around it. So I figured we should just circle back and talk about this whole thing. So for everybody who's unfamiliar, which is probably nobody listening to this pod, analytics dropped this epic report claiming or allegating that Forbes had created a shadow domain, so www.forbes.com, and was buying paid traffic through various sources to this page, which, you know, had lots of ads and lots of advertisers running what was effectively on a MFA site. So there's a lot of things here. So number one, allegations of a domain being spoofed and it getting flowed through to SSPs. Number two, verification companies who are paid to catch this stuff and prevent it from happening. I think, you know, none of them were able to do this. And number three, buyers were buying it. According to Forbes, this represented 1%. The language they used was 1% of our user base, not 1% of traffic, not 1% of ad spend. So, you know, that was a, you know, I think a thing that was questionable. And sidebar was taken down. And, you know, there's still a lot of conversation and questions and fingers pointing and everything like that. So, Ari, we'll start with you. Maybe a couple of days after dropping your piece, like, what's new? What are you thinking about? What should people be, you know, doing right now?
Yeah, I found it very helpful that various people involved in this reach out to me and give me clarifications. And I just sort of summarize it in the piece I wrote. I'll just kind of run through a couple of those points. One was, this idea that a subdomain might not be spoofing. And I think that's really discounted because we're able to find that the MRC's guidelines for invalid traffic specifically cover URL spoofing.
Sophisticated invalid traffic.
Sophisticated invalid
traffic. Intentional, yeah.
Yeah. And then related to that, some folks, including myself, were not sure if the verification companies really promised to discover this. And we were able to locate a blog post from IAS that specifically said, if you don't want to be spoofed, use our tags. We will find the URLs. That's a little embarrassing. The other thing that I found is that there are various people will say, oh, there are other shoes to drop. There are other shoes to drop, but no one will give me a lead on another shoe to drop. So I'm just sitting here waiting, you know, waiting for the shoes to drop.
So be specific. People are saying there are other publishers, likely yeah. premium publishers, that are doing this exact thing.
Exactly. Also, I hate, we don't always call out our investments, but since Sarah put out a new product release that will give you a indication of whether a domain is likely CNAME to a different company. And that's another data point in their metadata suite. So it's if folks are interested in figuring this out, they have some data for the first time on this.
Yeah. No, it's going to be super interesting. All right. So Lara, it's rare we have a representative of the buy side when we have these types of conversations. So what are you thinking?
Yeah, I think a couple of things here. I think we've been largely lucky on the buy side that MFA has been pretty easy to spot in the past. It's like throwaway site templates. You can normally look at a page and determine whether it's valid or not. So I think what kind of caught the industry by surprise here was that it was, you know, a trusted publication that you wouldn't necessarily accuse of doing something like this. So it's definitely caused some like re-scrutiny on our processes and how to actually spot this and what we ask from publishers. Second thing is that I'm with you that other folks are doing this too. You know, we've spotted it with a couple, probably less premium sort of publishers, but still like very high user count, you know, top 1,000 Comscore lists, where they will have a separate subdomain for their social traffic redirects specifically. And so, and that has a vastly different ad experience. And so those have been pretty easy to block because it's a whole different subdomain. It was less probably sophisticated than the www3 that Forbes did. But I think you're right that the industry will probably uncover a few more of these. And then on the verification side, like, yeah, it's disappointing that it wasn't caught. And I sort of hope that it spurs an increased level of scrutiny from the ad verification providers as well.
Laura, can you expand a little bit about what you just said with other publishers? So it's been explained to me that buying traffic on social against, you know, high performing article pages, against, you know, really targeted audiences is kind of one of the last legit traffic drivers for publishers. So basically what I'm hearing is that, yes, that's true, but also B, it's, you know, so good that, you know, it could be an area where more ads are on the page or it goes to, you know, an area that's got a different experience. Is that what you think is happening?
Yeah, I think two things there. One is for newer publishers that have legit editorial, unique content, social traffic is a great way to get on the radar. But then over time, you need to distribute your traffic through, you know, organic search and other in order to get buyer interest. One of our biggest flags for MFA across the board is what percentage of their traffic is coming from social. Anything above 40% is like super sus and it's going to get you flagged. Mm-hmm. Marketers largely don't want to pay against incentivized users. Like they don't want to show ads there because those users, when they're sort of doing clickbait or sort of browsing, you know, listicles or articles, they don't have their credit card in their hand. They're not going to purchase something. They're not going to fill out, you know, a form. And so the quality of those users at that time is much lower for marketers. And so they don't want that experience. Second thing is like, again, if you're having a different redirect for your primary, your direct users that come by search or, you know, just putting the URL in and a different ad experience for users you're directing via social, like the publisher itself then is recognizing that there's less valuable users because they're trying to massively monetize against higher ad count from the social traffic. Because they know they're not going to be users that they retain. They're there for a short flash and then they're gone.
Lara, is there a reliable way to tell that traffic is bought when it comes to the RTB pipes, the referral is probably not going to be there.
Yeah, the biggest way is through GA. So if you've got publisher relationships that are willing to share some GA data, there's some research firms that do a lot of this a lot. So like Rocket Deep Sea looks at it quite a bit. And then there's some more sort of commoditized commercial licenses. So we use SimilarWeb, which is like an analytics company that connects to a lot of GA data sources. So not perfect, but useful.
Right, but it wouldn't be real time. It would be sort of a negative targeting list. Yeah, got it. Okay.
I think the onus here is on SSPs. Like when they're onboarding new publishers, they should take a legit look at where their traffic sources are coming from to make sure that, you know, it's not too incentivized.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And as I was going to say, it's a good tip to keep that 40% or less benchmark in mind. Hopefully, people are paying attention. We'll probably put it in the newsletter, but Ari, you saw an article in Adweek that, you know, there's now so much snapback and course correction here that legit publishers are now being turned off because they're being called MFA and they're like, wait, I'm just a pub, dude.
Yeah, I know. There's reporting that people are upset with DoubleVerify declaring people to be MFA. And DoubleVerify, if you recall from a couple weeks ago when they launched their MFA solution, they very intentionally did not go black or white. They went gradients of MFA. And I think they thought that was more friendly to publishers, but ultimately they're giving that gun to the buyers to negative target based on sort of any shade of gray they wanted to, and publishers hate that.
All right. Well, I think we're going to be talking about this one for many months to come. We'll move on. Something neat and apropos of the conversation we just had with Lara. So 114 different paths to buying inventory. Maybe we found number 115 this week with, actually, this is pretty cool. Innovid, which is effectively an ad server for CTV and video, they launched a product called Harmony Direct, which is, I think, thusly named, you know, probably because it's from the ad server, the most direct path to CTV inventory. And there were some good publishers, Roku, that were talking about how they saw increased yield, increased revenue from this. Lara, what's your take on Harmony Direct?
Yeah, I think it's similar to how we're viewing a lot of this sort of DSP-SSP ad server convergence, where you've got like Trade Desk OpenPath initiatives, Yahoo Backstage, Magnite ClearLine, Pomatic Activate, and now sort of Innovid Harmony. I think the more choices we can give buyers to transact against the way they want to at the prices they want to, it is positive. But I think the downside is it's furthering fragmentation. And there's a lot of reasons why buyers, particularly agency buyers, use DSPs, and it's beyond just cost efficiency. You know, it's analytics automation, it's frequency management across multiple publishers, it's omni-channel campaign management, so like insights across audio, out of home, and CTV at the same time. And then there's also just operational efficiencies. It's like if you have to train 50 traders to use a couple platforms really well, do you want that to be 5 or do you want that to be 15? And what's sort of what's the operational loss that you might experience by fragmenting workflow tools too much? So I think there's benefits for, you know, specific isolated publisher buys, where if you're a buyer that's buying a lot of direct, it seems like a good value add for workflow automation. But if you're a pure play programmatic buyer, you know, right now you can't go all in on one platform. And sometimes the switching costs of a new platform can cause you more operational loss than the efficiency you gain back.
Yeah, I'll jump in here. I do want to disclose that unlike my previous statement about MIQ, Innovid is an advertiser on this podcast and sponsoring this episode. But we'll put that aside for a moment. So I was at the launch event at the New York Stock Exchange. I interviewed Zvika about his vision for Harmony, and my co-founder from Beeswax, Shamim, actually announced the product. So I have a lot of involvement here. The basic product, I'll just explain it if it wasn't clear, is like a programmatic guaranteed pipe that skips DSPs and SSPs. It basically goes from ad server to ad server, which is sort of deja vu because we were trying to build that in 2007 and we didn't get it done. So now we've got it done. And another thing that wasn't really reported, but that was presented pretty clearly in this event that I think it's worth discussing, is that Innovid has a fairly aggressive roadmap to empower actually DSPs with things like smarter reach and frequency control based on ad server data. So they're not, this is not an end run around DSPs and SSPs. It is an effort to utilize the data that's in the ad server to help various people in various ways. And so I think it's very interesting. It's something to keep an eye on. This will be the subject of my newsletter coming out on Monday, not just Innovid, but all the different activities in this kind of video SPO world.
This is new. This doesn't replace anyone or anything. This is like a ad server innovation that, you know, should be, you know, net helpful to DSPs and SSPs. If, as I understand what you're saying, if it's all true and comes to fruition.
Yeah, I think that's their vision. I think this first product they actually launched, the Harmony Direct, it's called, is cutting other people out. But their vision is not to be combating the other parties in the chain. But this product for Programmatic Guaranteed does do that.
Got it. Fascinating. All right. Moving on. So there is a privacy bill. And I wanted to read the headline, but for some reason the Senate's website is under maintenance as we record this. So unfortunately, I can't. But it's the American Privacy Rights Act. So it was introduced this week as draft legislation. And I'll just actually read some of Eric Seufert's summarization here, which is really good. The bill represents a comprehensive data privacy law that would, among other things, require a, quote, clear and conspicuous, unquote, opt-out mechanism for targeted advertising before it is delivered. That sounds like a lot, Ari.
It's a cookie banner, right? Banner. I think it is opt-in. So you need to get consumer consent to target ads. So it's a little more of the European model than what's been going on with like CCPA in California, which is effectively opt out. The opt in sounds like cookie banner is sufficient, but like terms of service, like just using it, legitimate interest would not be okay. So there is some degree of getting consumers to say it's okay. And I think very importantly, the government, the FTC, is tasked with creating a universal opt-out.
Right.
Like a can spam type situation, which is pretty interesting.
It also sounds logistically very, very hard to pull off. The government creating a universal opt-out.
Sure. The irony is that in order to opt out, they'd have to keep your data somewhere, right? You know, an email or phone number you have to give the government your email so that they can make sure you're not targeted. Which was kind of interesting.
Yep. And sounds like you had a conversation with a senior policy person in advertising about this who wants to remain nameless, but that gave you some more perspective. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I'll say that my bias going into this was it's about time. You know, we need a privacy law, even if there are some commercial consequences. It's not perfect, but it's much lighter than, say, GDPR in terms of compliance and paperwork and all the nonsense in Europe. And then I spoke to this person who is a very knowledgeable person who just wanted to be anonymous until he makes his position official. And he said it's the worst of both worlds because it's opt-in, unlike opt-out. There is no state preemption. That's a debatable issue because there's different versions of the bill going around. But the idea that you'd also have state laws that potentially had additional requirements is very worrisome. And probably the biggest issue, and I saw this as well, is what's called the private right of action. Which effectively means that consumers, class action suits can sue for under this law and get damages, which if we know the way things work in the United States, it means virtually every scaled ad tech or data broker company would be subject to lawsuits for, you know, having a button missing on their homepage or having, you know, whatever they do scrutinized in a way that's very difficult to defend. So I think that one is the one that's really raising some eyebrows.
So is this person concerned that this is going to really have an effect on digital advertising in the U.S.?
I think yes. Yes, I think that person is. And I think we should expect that any law would have an effect. Like any law is going to reduce the amount of data available. But the question is whether it has a really burdensome, costly effect or not. One thing I will give a lot of props to this law about is unlike GDPR, they really carve out small businesses and other use cases that are pretty reasonable. The law only takes effect for companies with sort of a minimum amount of data records and or revenue. So effectively, unlike in Europe, you won't have every small restaurant with a cookie banner or burdensome legal proof about the way they handle IDs. Or another aspect is employee data, which is subject to GDPR, even though it doesn't make any sense and causes a big burden in Europe. So I think it's smart that the bill as drafted, the last draft I saw, excludes all of that.
Yeah, totally agree. Wow, can you imagine a dry cleaner spending $50 a month on digital ads now needing to be in the middle of this thing?
That's what happens in Europe. I mean, there is no exception for small businesses in Europe. Create a web form and accept a bunch of emails to come to your kid's wedding, you need to be GDPR compliant. It's madness.
That's rough. Okay, we'll keep an eye on this one as well. Moving on, in the realm of privacy friendliness and targeting, ID5 announced a $20 million Series B this week. Full disclosure, my fund, as well as Ari, are investors in ID5. And this is interesting, I think, from a couple perspectives. So number one, according to the company, this is the largest fundraise for any universal identity company to date. And then number two, some of the stats that they quoted are interesting. So as we've mentioned before, you know, when we had Mike from Sincera on, and I believe Matthew, ID5 is the largest identifier out there. I think that's well known. According to the company, ID5 is now powering almost 50% of all digital ad transactions. So, you know, they've like reached a real scale, which is pretty impressive. And also, interestingly, TransUnion and S4S Ventures, which is the venture fund connected to S4, Sir Martin Sorrell's firm, they led the round. So big round, company that's got a lot of momentum and a couple of interesting strategics are involved. All right, what's your take?
Yeah, well, 50% of ad transactions, I would say they're probably present on those. They're not transacting
right.
Those, right?
Connected to, right. Sorry.
Yeah, so I'm an investor, but I'll just try to put on my objective hat, which is they're clearly a leader in probabilistic IDs. They're probably by scale number one. And so that's the positive. And Matthew's an operator and the progress is amazing. And the skeptical case is there a future for probabilistic IDs? And I actually have had a couple of people come up to me since this announcement came out saying, how does this make sense? How can you invest in probabilistic IDs? And it's a good question. Did you get that feedback, Eric, when you were looking at this? You shake his head.
No. I mean, I'm shaking my head at an audio only podcast. I was on vacation last week. Cut the guy some slack. We clearly believe that there's a future for probabilistic IDs. Deterministic IDs are obviously great, super important, but they're very, very limited in scale. You need probabilistic to ultimately have, you know, a fuller view and be able to do targeting at scale. And with the you know, sort of continued adoption of IDs like this, and with the I think promise of and benefit of things like machine learning, I think they're only going to get better and better. So that's the bet here, and then the bet that you need a universal ID and one that's privacy centric with the deprecation of cookies.
Lara, does MIQ have sort of a policy on ID or an outlook on the subject about probabilistic versus deterministic?
Yeah, I think it depends on the market. Like in markets like the US, you can be a little bit more stringent on trying to do deterministic only because there's just greater scale and fewer privacy laws around consumer data and how you handle it that make it easier for companies to do that. I think in markets like rest of the world, you know, APAC, MENA, where ID5 is really prolific, there's a massive need for it, just because that level of authenticated data just does not exist in those markets, very mobile-friendly app markets, things like that. So depending on where you're talking about in the world, you can have a different level of scrutiny for the methodology of a lot of these companies, but there's definitely value for both. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is like a lot of the, you know, true deterministic authenticated players, the incumbents in the space, they're also still using probabilistic signals. They're just not talking about it. And so, you know, savvy buyers know that it's all kind of a wash right now.
Also, Eric Seufert had an interesting article called, like, I think it was called Apple's Nuclear Option, where he went into some depth about the possibilities of IP addresses being totally removed from iOS. And I learned something new in that article, which is that the telecoms have been pushing pretty hard against Apple and against IP removal. And in fact, Apple's current IP removal system called Local Relay or something like that is disabled on T-Mobile devices for competitive reasons. So when, well, I think the conventional wisdom is IP addresses are going away over the next, year or two, but that may not be the case. It might actually get caught in regulatory and other issues as people like Google and Apple try to push their vision of the data future, and there's significant pushback.
That's fascinating. Maybe taking a step back, and we'll talk about the meta point here. So ID5 Series B, over the course of the last few weeks, some of this we've covered on a pod, some of it we haven't. So Vibe, Kevel, TV Scientific, Prescient AI, that retail media company that name escapes me, that we talked about, they've all raised significant rounds. We haven't had, I think, a string of fundraise announcements like this in the year and change that we've been doing the pod. So as the crypto folks say, the crypto Twitter folks say, and I'll ask it as a question, are we so back?
We're so back.
Are we so back?
We're back. Ad tech's hot again. Here we go.
There we go. No, it's interesting. The public markets, as a class, there's ups and downs. I was doing some recaps for LLP update. TTD up 25% Q1. AppLovin up like 76% Q1. So there's lots of pockets of momentum in the space. Let's hope it keeps going for the rest of the year.
Google, Alphabet, who everyone says is just a shell of its former self that's falling apart, that they're losing everything, and hit its all-time high this week, all-time high earlier this week. And it's just, if there's one company people like to crap on, it's Alphabet, and yet they keep moving forward, and we'll see what happens with AI and everything else.
Yeah, before we go, maybe we'll sneak in one more. So last week there was a rumor that Google was looking at buying HubSpot for $34 billion, which would be by an order of magnitude of th almost 3x the largest acquisition that Google ever made. Motorola Mobility was the largest one to date at 12 and a half. What do you think of that potential acquisition? So forget about the regulatory, like, will it get passed? If you had $110 billion of cash, do you spend a third of it on, buying your way into MarTech and CRM, or do you take even smaller amount of it and buy some of these up and coming AI companies?
Well, I think that clearly the impetus for doing this is to learn more about the conversions that your advertising produces. There's so much more in-depth information in a HubSpot CRM than there is in a Google Analytics pixel that maybe only has a single value on it from what someone purchased or what someone did. And in a B2B context, that's incredibly important because all the activities of moving someone down a sales funnel that might take 3 months or 6 months is totally missing from Google Analytics, Google Ads, all their other properties. With HubSpot, you have the most in-depth view of customer journeys, and every little piece of information that you're adding to those profiles is a improvement in targeting, ROI, ROAS, et cetera. So in my point of view, that's why you do the deal. And then the negative is you have to run a big CRM system that's totally out of the DNA of Google and has high support costs and high touch and 200,000 customers. So that's my positive negatives.
How much better could Google's revenue, how much more could Google squeeze out of Google with the addition of HubSpot?
I don't. All right. I mean,
Or is it just defensive?
no, I think it's offensive. I think you'd be doing it to make more money. You'd be competing more with LinkedIn for the B2B side. I think it's a very strong B2B play here. You'd be competing much more with LinkedIn. You'd be understanding the customers at different parts of the journey. You might be opening up two new forms of revenue that Google doesn't touch at all right now, like reactivation or Or moving people from mid funnel to bottom funnel. You know, folks who already have emails captured and getting them excited, that's currently going to email and maybe to Meta. So I think there's a lot there. It's hard. I would not be able to estimate at all, you know, numbers.
Are any thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I think it, if for marketers, especially B2B, as Ari said, like it strengthens their use Google for everything proposition, and sort of is another toolkit in their, you know, enterprise marketing stack. So it makes sense why they'd go after it. Some marketers, you know, are full Google opt-in, and if they're also HubSpot consumers, that'd be valuable for them. And then, yeah, no comment on the regulatory anti-competitive side.
Yeah, yeah, it's been a tough year, tough couple of years for big M&A, with Adobe, Figma being, I think, the one that comes to mind. But we'll see. Personally, I'd love to see them make a run at Perplexity, but hey, never know. This has been awesome. Thank you, Ari. Want to take us home?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a great episode, Lara. Thank you so much for sharing your research with us. As a reminder, we're going to be providing a link to download the entire presentation in our newsletter. So Lara, again, thanks so much. Eric, it's always a pleasure. We'll see you in Miami, and people could harass us about getting people on the street interviews.
Thanks, guys.
Please harass Ari.